is declared. More than 960 people have now died. The father of MH17 victim Liam Sweeney says the family wants the body back so it can grieve. It's unclear when his remains will be flown from the Netherlands to the UK after he was formally identified on Monday. The Newcastle fan was one of almost 300 people killed when the plane crashed in eastern Ukraine. Barry Sweeney says it's been very hard.
It's very difficult because now we're looking to closure. We want to get Liam home and we want to send him off in the right way. We need to move on. We need to be able to grieve as a family. And the sooner we get him home and we get him buried, that's when we can start looking to the future.
UKIP leader Nigel Farage is understood to be standing for a parliamentary seat in Kent at the next general election. It's believed he'll try to become the MP for South Thanet. The judge in the Oscar Pistorius trial is to deliver her verdict in 5 weeks' time. The athlete's defence team made its closing arguments today. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
Their goal is revenge for the persecution of men of intellect and science throughout the Middle and Dark Ages by the church, by the kings and queens, by the governments, and by the ignorant mob. That's why they want to destroy all existing governments, destroy all existing religions, and put the shackles on the mob.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why are we crushing our homeless people in dust carts? What drives people to spend the night in a wheelie bin? Initial reports that a 34-year-old homeless man from Swindon, Matthew Simmons, had been assaulted before his body parts were found in a Bristol recycling site have been discounted this week. Seems he was only rough sleeping in a wheelie bin and failed to shout loud enough to get the attention of the bin men. Looks like they just emptied him into a dust cart to be crushed. That's the second such death this week, with the freshly crushed body of an unnamed man being discovered in a Dublin rubbish tip too. The same thing happened here less than 2 years ago to unfortunate Canadian student in Bristol, Garrett Elsley, and also in Brighton to Scott Williams, who was back in 2009. So after the latest grisly incident, we asked what drives people to spend the night in the wheelie bin and look at the plight of Bristol's ever-growing army of homeless people. And Gaza again. We look at Zionism's powerful Westminster lobby and how the Israeli state lost its soul in the 1960s by occupying Palestine, that is, the so-called occupied territories, and by sacking Mossad's Issa Harel, who was the only intelligence officer in the world who was still actively hunting down Nazi war criminals. And as NATO pulls out of Afghanistan, the highest-ranking US soldier so far, a general, is shot dead at an Afghan army training facility. On the centenary this week of Britain's entry into World War I, we hear how Britain came into the war. And also, we go to have a look at the 2001 A Space Odyssey after the last week's programme we did about creation and evolution, and listen to Arizona Talk radio host and US Naval Intelligence veteran William Cooper, his thoughts on 2001. But first, Martin, some momentous stuff this week in various parts of the world, particularly, let's start, I think, with some interesting moves by the Russians to introduce sanctions. Actually, it's retaliatory sanctions against our sanctions. They don't want any of our European or American food anymore.
Well, yes, I mean, the situation there has been overshadowed by what's been happening in Gaza. But, of course, in many ways, it's more serious in terms of geopolitical implications. This very interesting material coming out about the loss of this flight, MH17, and I'm afraid most of it doesn't, in fact, fit in with the Western narrative.
Do you want to just bring us up to date with that? Because it's been a month or so now since it happened. What's the latest? Because we were initially told, weren't we? Let's just think about what we knew initially, things we've discussed here, that the plane was off its usual flight. It was several hundred miles to the north of its usual flight path, and there were questions about what it was doing over a war zone anyway. So what's the latest on what we know?
All
about it? Well, we've got the black boxes, for example.
To summarise, the plane was off its normal course and had been redirected in a certain direction, presumably by air traffic control at Kiev. The air traffic control tapes of the air traffic control were seized by the secret police in Ukraine, and we've not been allowed to hear them. For example, the Malaysian Airlines that disappeared in the southern hemisphere, those were made available almost immediately, but we've not heard any of them because they've been seized by the Kiev authorities. The Russians then gave a press conference where they showed their satellite images of what happened, which definitely showed two Ukrainian combat aircraft in the vicinity of the plane. And of course the Kiev government had denied that there were any planes in the vicinity, and now it's transpired that there were. And the general who gave the press conference was also daring, or basically challenging, the US to come up with its own satellite imagery, which, because they presumably have satellite imagery, and they should be quite straightforward to work out what's happened here. The other thing that's very interesting is that BBC Russia sent correspondents, Russian-speaking correspondents, into the area. They interviewed locals who all said they said seen the plane being shot down by these Kiev aircraft. That was then uploaded to the website of BBC Russia in Russian, and then BBC London freaked out and had it removed. But of course, if you go on the web, you can find it. It's in Russian, but there's translations available. So in other words, the evidence is piling up that the Kiev government is by far the most likely culprit for shooting down the plane. Now, that might be an accident, or it might not be an accident, because of course NATO intelligence services over the years have engaged in various provocations of this kind, not least, for example, the shooting of the protesters in the Maidan Square, which began the coup at the beginning of this process.
That is disputed by Kiev, isn't it?
Well, Kiev has come up with all sorts of things. They've supposedly provided a tape of rebels talking to each other, admitting that they'd shot down the aircraft, until some eagle-eyed person pointed out this tape had been uploaded the day before the plane had been shot down. So what's going on here, I think, is that NATO's Gladio networks, which have been operating in Western and Eastern Europe since the 1940s, are probably behind these incidents. I'm not saying for sure, but people have got to get their heads around the fact that NATO does engage in dirty tricks. It does.
Okay, what about
the question is, have they engaged in dirty tricks on this occasion?
What about a motive? Because things are ramping up with the Russian sanctions being imposed a year now.
Well, the motive is quite clear. As a result of the shooting down of the plane, various European countries agreed to go along with sanctions with Russia, which previously they'd been resisting. And of course, the purpose of this is to break the economic links between the European Union and the Russians, to the benefit of the US
okay,
military
so how,
industrial complex.
What actual real sort of geopolitical and economic effect is it going to have, the Russians banning imports of foodstuffs from these sanctioning countries, which are basically the EU and North America?
Well, basically, the Russians are not escalating to the same level of sanctions as are being imposed on them. I mean, their position all along has been sanctions are going to hurt us, but they're going to hurt you more.
So how much food goes from us to the Russians?
A fair bit. I don't really know. I'd have to look it up. But, I mean, obviously, there's quite a lot of trade between... I used to live in Eastern Poland, and there's quite a lot of trade between Eastern Poland and Russia. You know, it's what you'd expect. It's like trade between us and France and Ireland. And, of course, this whole process has been... If it has been engineered by the Gladio networks inside NATO, including the shootings at the beginning and the Odessa massacre, and now the shooting down of the plane, but the Russians, of course, are preparing. They probably know exactly what happened, and they'll be speaking behind the scenes to NATO and saying, "We know you shot that plane down, and if you don't back down, we're going to tell everybody in the world exactly how you did it."
Okay, there's several possibilities with the plane, aren't there? Either a surface-to-air missile, or a air-to-air missile. Yep. Or possibly a cannon fired from one of these Sukhoi fighter jets, or possibly a bomb on board. So yes. What evidence is there of any of that?
Well, I mean, we'll have to wait for the investigations, but of course the black boxes were handed over by the rebels to the Russians, who then handed them over to the International Aviation Authority, who then handed them to the British to analyse. Although, why we can't hear, I mean, this is very suspicious, why can't we hear the air traffic control? Because that should clarify a lot of things.
Well, it would,
those tapes were seized on the day, and we've also got a...
You know what this reminds me of, Martin, if I can just interrupt you, is that the Metropolitan Police, who has been so much discussion about corruption of them, I mean, the Independent on Sunday had a massive article last Sunday, went in straight after 7-7 and seized all the CCTV footage from right across the London Underground, and we've not seen a single picture of the four alleged bombers on 7-7 released, showing them actually getting onto or on the buses or the trains.
Yes, and people have got to see this in the context of the fact that the Italian police force have been investigating NATO intelligence services for decades, and they are absolutely convinced. Imposimato, who's head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this, which came out in 2012, NATO do engage. Not the NATO structure is like a huge kind of labyrinth, but elements within the NATO structure, I'll put it no stronger than that, definitely have been involved in provocational terrorism. The bombing of Bologna railway station, the Dortmund beer hall massacre, the Brabant massacres in Belgium, which of course was also linked to the De Truy affair and paedophilia and so on. The fact is that when the Russians say, we think that you carried shot down this plane in order to blacken our name, that's a perfectly reasonable supposition. They may or may not have done it, but for the Russians to say that NATO shot down the plane in order to try and make us look bad is, prima facie, is a perfectly reasonable thing for them to say,
okay,
given the history.
Some people are pointing the finger at this judgment that I mentioned in the first hour. The Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission has made judgments against both Bush and Blair for war crimes in relation to the Iraq war, an illegal war. And also, back in November last year, Israel was charged with war crimes and genocide by them. This is a complete judgment of the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal I'm looking at here on globalresearch.ca. Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission versus the State of Israel. It names specific names of civil servants over in Israel who they are saying are guilty of very serious war crimes, and if they come to Malaysia or various that part of the world anyway, they are subject to be arrested and imprisoned for it.
Yes, so in other words, there would be a motive for picking on the Malaysians as the fall guys.
But this is Israeli war crimes. Why would that possibly... How could that possibly be connected to a shoot down of Malaysian airliners?
Well,
over in Malaysia, the first one, the MH370, and this latest one in Ukraine, MH17.
Well, if you're going to take down a civilian airliner as part of your psychological warfare operation, you've got to choose which airliner you're going to take down. Now, the Malaysians have blotted their copybook with the Israelis and with the West for war crimes tribunals. They defied the IMF in 1998 and introduced capital controls. Mahathir Mohamad, the former president of Malaysia, has accused the US and Israel of being behind 9/11. So there's all sorts of reasons why the Malaysians might be singled out. But the other point I'd make is this, that Schiphol Airport, security at Schiphol Airport from which the plane departed, is controlled by an Israeli-based company called ICTS, which was set up by former Shin Bet agents.
Hang on, isn't that where the underpants bomber got on the plane?
That's where the underpants bomber got on the plane without going through security, according to Kurt Haskell, who submitted an affidavit to the trial of the underpants bomber.
Hang on a minute, Martin, look, we've got to stop again, because ICTS, this private security company, let the underpants bomber get on a plane, and then he blew up his bomb, even though it was rather ineffective in his underpants.
Yeah.
And yet they've still got the contract to run security at an airport, where they let a bomber on a plane.
Well, what Kurt Haskell and his wife, they submitted an affidavit to the underpants bomber's trial, saying that they saw him being taken onto the plane without going through security. Kurt Haskell is a corporate lawyer, so he knew how to make his concerns effective. But most people don't realise this. Most people don't realise that security in many key airports is not controlled by public sector bodies. It's controlled by contractors. And of course the Israelis pushed themselves, and ICTS in particular, which controlled all three airports on 9/11. ICTS also pops up there. These Israelis pushed themselves forward as being the experts on airline security. So they then win these contracts. But if they are then implicated in the events concerned, that's how you do it. If you're controlling the security at Schiphol, then it's quite easy for you to get your bomber onto the plane, isn't it?
But I mean, surely if there was any truth to that, that the Dutch government or the authorities in Holland would have rescinded the contract and said, well, you've let a bomber onto the plane, sorry, we're kicking you out.
No, because what happens is they've wormed their way in. It's like Veritas Systems being in control of the CCTV on the London Underground. Most people don't realise that private companies based in Israel end up controlling the CCTV and things like the British Underground. Now, that, of course, means that if the Israeli state or elements within the Israeli state wants to carry out provocational terrorist acts, and they probably were working closely with NATO Gladio networks, these things probably overlap, then controlling the private security is the vector for most of the terrorism that we're seeing. Blackwater, Xi and all the rest of it, they are the terrorists.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, several weeks ago, the Home Secretary Theresa May announced two inquiries into Westminster-related child abuse, and one of them has hit the buffers almost straight away. That was the long-term inquiry, which was going to be chaired by Baroness Butler Schloss. Her husband was actually Attorney General while this is all supposed to be going on, and didn't prosecute, and there's questions about whether anybody would feel confident in him running that inquiry. But the other inquiry, Martin, was chaired by a chap called Peter Wanless. Now, Peter Wanless is the chief executive now of the NSPCC. Now, if you go onto the internet, you'll see there's quite a lot of pictures of Jimmy Savile with his NSPCC badges on. I mean, he was very, very closely connected to the NSPCC, it seems, as one of their chief fundraisers. That's not the only question about whether the chief executive of the NSPCC is an appropriate person, because Peter Wanless was also the personal private secretary to Michael Portillo. Now, Portillo was involved in this so-called scandal, which then was all denied back in the early 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s. What's the point of choosing people who it seems have been implicated in previous scandals and cover-ups to run these inquiries? The first one has already fallen. How long is Peter Wanless going to last?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a very, very stinky smell around all of this. And, of course, if you want to cover it up, then you definitely bring people in to deal with the inquiry who are going to come up with the result that you want them to come up with. That's got to be the fear, hasn't it?
The allegations back in the 80s were that Peter Lilly and Michael Portillo were in some kind of love triangle with the gay footballer Justin Fashanu, who then died in mysterious circumstances very shortly afterwards. Let's go back now to an interview I conducted this week with a guy called Pete, and he was telling me just how he was actually intimately involved with a journalist who was trying to cover this story at the time.
Okay, yeah, my name's Pete. It's just something that I was closely involved in through a very close friend of mine who was a freelance journalist. I used to work in a bar, and this chap used to come in regularly and have a drink, and he would have a late drink and lock in, and we'd have a chat every evening, and we became quite close, sort of bar buddies, if you know what I mean. Anyway, one day he came in with a story where he said that this is a potential dynamite shell that could bring down the Conservative government of the time. This is in the 80s. I can give you specifically when it was, but not the date off the top of my head, because it was around about, it was at the same time as that Stephen Milligan guy was found dead with a satsuma in his mouth and a plastic bag with a cord round his neck.
He was an MP, I think, wasn't he?
He was, Stephen Milligan, and it was the height of the Tory sleaze scandal of that particular time, you know. Anyway, this chap, the journalist, has come into the bar one night. He's gone, "I've got this amazing story." He said, "I've got two really high-ranking government officials in a gay love triangle with the gay football star, Justin Fashanu." And I was, like, fascinated by this. This is incredible. If you brought this out into the open, it could be really dynamic. Anyway, he didn't have the smoking gun evidence to really actually go ahead to the press and reveal it yet.
So he couldn't quite stand the story up?
Not quite, no. Anyway, when Milligan was found dead with the satsuma in his mouth, laced with amyl nitrate, I said to this chap, I said, "Well, do you not think that this is the right time to publish this story? You know, because it is, you know, this, you know, the more of this information that comes out about the Conservative government, then the more damaging it will be for them." A day or two later, he came in and he had a copy of the Daily Express. And in the Daily Express, he showed me this half-page report that he had written dealing with two unnamed government officials in a gay love triangle with the gay footballer Justin Fashanu. The following morning, or the following day, I mean, I don't know exactly when he flew out, but Justin Fashanu mysteriously vanished and flew out to America. I think he went to Miami or somewhere like that. Gone, disappeared off the scene. My journalist friend, well, I didn't see him again. He used to come in every single day, and he didn't come in again. And then about a week later, his girlfriend came in. I said, what's happened? You know, and he said, oh, he's had to go and stay with his grandmother because the day after the news report appeared in the paper, he got pressure from MI5 and he had to go and live with his grandmother in Scotland. And I've never seen him again. He just disappeared completely off the scene. The two government ministers that were implicated, which never got named, were Peter Lilly and Michael Portillo.
So why do you think your mate disappeared, Pete?
According to his girlfriend, the following day, the MI5 came and put pressure on him, and he had to disappear off the scene. He had to go and retreat up to Scotland to live with his grandmother, and I've never seen his name in print ever since.
Well, do you think this has got any real relevance for what's been going on today? In 2014, we've also had the Savile scandal and all sorts of other things.
Yes, well, I think it's completely relevant, because the other twist to that the story that I just told you is that about 2 months later... I'm not exactly sure of the exact timescale because it was about 20 years ago. But Justin Fashanu was found hanged in a lock-up in Shoreditch. Apparently, suicide. But who knows? I mean, because if this really is the implication that these people are involved in all this, whatever it's sexual dalliances, and they're trying to keep it hidden up, and they're trying to put on this face of, like, respectability, this false facade that they try to portray, and in fact there's all this sleaze and corruption going on behind the scenes, whether it's with young boys or underage children, or whether it is in simply a gay sort of thing that is not being revealed and being hidden up, then it's obviously relevant, because these people are still in the public eye, and they should be exposed for the liars and potential implication is that they could even be involved in getting rid of these people. It's terrible. The whole thing just really stinks of putting people in charge of these investigations that are actually implicated themselves, so they've got something to hide, and they will hide the truth, and they almost definitely will hide the truth, and the quicker the truth is exposed, the better we can expose these people for what they actually really are. Whoever is conducting this investigation should not have any connection to the Conservative Party, to Westminster, or to any political organisation at all. They should be completely and utterly independent, and they should not have any bias to bear against or for. I would say it has to be completely independent, so that the actual real truth can come out, and not a whitewash of lies and obfuscation of the truth.
Going back to your journalist friend who disappeared at the time, have you any idea what happened to him? I mean, have you ever seen any articles by him or whatever in the since then?
Well, when I've researched his name on the internet, I've not seen anything that's connected to him in any way at all ever since that time. And at the time he was an up and coming journalist just trying to find his way in the freelance journalism. And as far as I can tell, he's disappeared off the face of the earth. I've never seen any trace of him. And I'd love to find out what happened to him, quite frankly.
Well, we will see if we can find out what happened to him. But Martin, ultimately, this is a bit of barroom talk, but it's actually an interesting bit of testimony from somebody who was around at the time and who's prepared to name names as he was there. What is essential thrust of this is, it seems that people who are implicated in these abuse scandals are actually being put in charge of the inquiry. Certainly, there are all sorts of questions about whether anybody who has been abused would trust Peter Wanless from the NSPCC to run an inquiry, would actually be prepared to go into confidence with him about the way they were abused.
Well, yes, I mean, that's obviously got to be the fear, that because these networks are so well dug in at the top of the establishment, that they will be protected. And, of course, Butler Schloss had to resign because her brother, Sir Michael Havers, was the Attorney General at the time. I think what we're looking at here is not just child abuse, there's plenty of evidence of that, but it's the uses of child abuse at the top of the establishment in terms of blackmail, in terms of steering people to fulfil certain kind of goals. So as I mentioned before, the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was definitely being used by MI5 at one stage in order to entrap political figures in Northern Ireland.
Well, that was in the news again last week, actually, Kinkora. Yeah. But the main point that Pete is making there is, surely anyone that's running an inquiry should have absolutely no connection with the establishment or any of the main political parties.
Well, that you would have thought so. And the question is, are these people basically going to cover it up? And I'm afraid the answer probably is yes.
You mentioned also the Dutroux scandal earlier. How does that, do you think, relate? I mean, is anything we can learn from the Dutroux scandal over in Belgium, which was very much outed? And in fact, they had the biggest demonstration in Belgian history over that, back, I think it was in the 1990s. What can we learn from that about what may be going on here?
Well, I think what I take from all of this is that intelligence services use paedophilia as a means of political control. So if you can get politicians compromised by having sex with underage partners, then you can then basically blackmail them to make them do what you want. That's got to be the fear that that's what's going on here.
Yeah, also in the 1980s, early 90s, there was the death of this MP, Stephen Milligan, that Pete's talking about there, who was found with an orange in his mouth in some kind of weird sexual pose, hanging. That does look as if it may be very well be connected to this Justin Fashanu death and to this gay sex triangle, possibly. Any thoughts about whether that... I mean, he's saying there he thinks that possibly MI5 murdered Stephen Milligan.
Well, I think the idea that the intelligence services use paedophilia as a tool is absolutely straightforward.
But could the security services murder an MP?
Yes, yes, they could. There's no reason to presume otherwise. I mean, what we know of NATO's intelligence services, if you actually look, the history is there. NATO's secret armies, for example, by Daniel Ganzer, who's a Swiss academic. In Posimato's book in Italy, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, he being head of the Italian Supreme Court. There is MI6, CIA and other Western intelligence services have engaged in terrorism and have used things like paedophilia in order to blackmail targets. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
And I would suggest that anybody that does know anything about this kind of thing should go and speak to the police, but then they're also obviously encouraged to talk about it with journalists too.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, it's a very sad story, a sorry tale in the news this week on the BBC website. There's no indication that a man whose body was found at an Avonmouth waste facility had been assaulted, police have said this week. Wiltshire police are now leading an investigation into how the body of Swindon man Matthew Simmons, 34, ended up at the Biffa recycling plant in St Andrews Road in Bristol on Friday. The investigation remains focused in Swindon as it's been established that his body was transported with commercial recycling waste from a site in the area. Preliminary post-mortem examination and further tests are required to determine the cause of death. The Force's specialist family liaison officers continue to provide support to his family. But the principle here is, and I'm joined now by Paul Hazeldean, who's the General Manager for Crisis Centre Ministries here in Bristol, and also Alan Goddard, Operational Manager of Changing Lives, and maybe I'll ask you first, Paul, is that we've got people actually sleeping in wheelie bins. How have we come to that in the 21st century?
People have been sleeping rough throughout history, but it's the problem of sleeping rough and people being forced to sleep rough because they've lost their homes, they've lost anywhere to live, that is increasing, and that's due to the economic environment.
Just give us an idea of what the local authority, maybe Bristol City Council, because they say that they've got a duty to house people, but it seems that that isn't actually happening.
Absolutely, they have a legal obligation to house people, and they're doing the best they can in very different circumstances.
But if they have a legal duty to house people, how come people aren't being housed? Is it simply that they can't afford the lawyers to fight for what is their legal right?
There's a lot of legal niceties about this, you have a duty to house people, but there is a process that people have to go through in order to get housed, and that process is not an easy one for many people.
I'd say maybe labyrinthine even.
Yes, it can be. There are lots of forms to fill out, there are appointments to keep, and if you make a mistake, if you don't turn up, then the process doesn't work for you and you have to start again, and people can't cope with it, they give up, they can't handle it, all kinds of problems get in the way.
Okay, tell us how you came into doing this kind of work, Paul, and also what the scale is and how you've seen that change over the last few years.
How I got into it was a bit of an accident. I knew the chair of the board of Crisis Centre Ministries, and the guy who was running it at the time, Derek Groves, was too ill to continue, and they needed somebody to step in and keep the thing going while they worked out what to do next, and that was back in 2000.
Okay. But what about the scale of things? How have you seen things change since 2000, the last, 14 years?
Yes. The problems have got far, far worse. The housing difficulties have increased dreadfully, and the economic problems mean that the level of debt has increased, so people are losing their accommodation that way. Family breakups mean that there are more units of accommodation needed, because when families break up you need more accommodation. People losing their jobs means they go into debt.
I mean, it might sound trite, but could you put a rough sort of percentage on it? How much have you seen it increase, from what figures? You might want to come in, Alan.
Well, I think it's really difficult because people move around the country so much.
Yes.
I think that's one of the difficulties that the council got, because they will only take responsibility for the people actually in Bristol. So if you come to Cardiff like I did, they'd be saying, well, go back to your own area, and they would take responsibility for you. But in reality, most people who are homeless are very often running away from situations that they're in, so they move the area.
Now tell us a bit about Changing Lives. What is it?
Well, Changing Lives was set up about 4 years ago. I came to work Crisis Centre Ministries going back 7 years ago, and I felt we needed to start in an income, basically. So we started opening up very large charity shops selling furniture. We're about to open one in Old Market very shortly. We have one in Henbury, one in Cleveland, one in Ailsley, and a big large warehouse, and we will be opening a lot more. But I spent time on the streets myself. I found myself homeless in 2000 or 1999. I spent nearly a year on the streets.
Can I ask you how you were made homeless? How did you get there?
Really, I was chronic alcoholic. I'd been sectioned 6 times. They threw the key away on me. And I'd be honest with you, I found God. God came into my life, and I decided I wanted to change. And in July the 27th, the year 2000, I got myself into a Christian rehab just 14 years ago, and I haven't drank since.
Okay. What about the scale of the problem, though? How have you seen it increase?
The scale is enormous. You know, I left Crisis Centre Ministries just a few months ago, and they were feeding on average 600 people a day in Bristol. Not all homeless, but people with problems and challenges, probably around 100 homeless, but lots of them people live in temporary accommodation, like the Salvation Army, maybe, you know, Jamaica Street Hostel. So people who are really homeless, they are homeless because it's not their home. It's a temporary accommodation. And they've closed loads of hostels around the city over the past couple of years. So that puts more people onto the street. More people, as Paul said, find themselves in debt. So they end up on the streets. Only last week, even though I don't work Christ Centre Ministries anymore, I helped a man who was an ex-serviceman. He'd been on the street for quite some time. He was a chronic alcoholic. I arranged a detox for him. We oversaw it, an alcohol detox. And now I'm glad to say that he's now 3 weeks sober, and he's living in an ex-serviceman's house. He was in the army. He suffered from all sorts of things to do with the war and everything. But now getting his life back on track.
Okay.
So one of the things we've seen change very much over the last few years is the folk who came into us used to be the street homeless. Mm. You know, it used to be very clearly it was that segment of the population. And now we're getting people coming in, not only living in hostels, but people who've got their own accommodation but just cannot afford food. And so we're getting a whole range of people who 2-3 years ago would never have dreamt of going into a homeless centre to get help, and now they're driven to it because they've got no other option.
Now
that is absolutely criminal.
Crisis Centre Ministries is a face militaries no ministries is a faith-based organisation. How much does the established church, like the Church of England and these kind of organisations, how much help do you get from them?
We get very little from denominations. In fact, I don't think we get any denominational support, but we get an immense amount of support from individual churches within within Bristol. So, yes, we are very grateful for that. But it's the churches and the individuals within those churches that support us.
Can you give us an idea of the range of support there is for the homeless? Because I think many of us see homeless people. We'd like to do something, but then you feel, well, you know, maybe give somebody a pound or something. But we want to see that the city is actually geared up to help people and to help them out of that situation, rather than this whole business of, it's almost like a kind of psychological trick. If you see homeless people on the street begging, then it concentrates the mind of the wealthier population to think, well, I better make sure I toe the line, otherwise I might end up there. So, I mean, one of the things I can remember from the early 1980s was being shocked to see the first homeless people on the streets of London. So this is a kind of, it's almost like built into the system under which we live, that they see it as quite good to have homeless people out on the street, in that it concentrates the minds of everyone else.
I'm not sure that most people look at homeless people and think, I could be there. I think the expectation is that, you know, the folk who are on the streets, that they are a different sort of person, that they've done dreadful things, they they're responsible for stuff, that sort of things that I would never do. They've been irresponsible in ways that I would never be. And that's what most people think, until the day when they themselves become homeless.
But isn't there a fear in the back of people's minds? What are your thoughts about this one, Alan?
Well, I think just what Paul was saying is true. You know, most people now don't get pay awards very often. And lots of people basically are living month to month on salaries. And I really do believe this, that most people are just maybe two or three paydays away from being homeless, because they live to their means, they save very little, and they don't have a great deal of money. And addiction affects everyone. I think this is the other thing. You know, I know we're talking about homelessness, but very often it's either an addiction or a relationship breakdown that actually takes you to the streets. And I think also that what you would find is that if we weren't feeding a lot of the people in Bristol, like Paul says, we would find an awful lot more people on the streets, because we're allowing them to stay in their house or their flats, and we're feeding them. And that allows them to stay in it. Because, you know, the biggest one for me, where, you know, we need to get our head around this, is said so many times, but the bedroom tax have got to be sorted out. That is the one thing in our country that the government just can't get their head round. At the end of the day, they have no one-bedroom flats in Bristol going, and yet now they're penalising people. If it's in a two-bedroom flat, they've got to pay an extra £20 a week or whatever it is. So they pay extra, but they would be very happy, a lot of them, to move to a one-bedroom flat.
But isn't it surely that the idea is to put a bit of pressure on that person with a two-bedroom flat to actually get a tenant in, or to get somebody in, a lodger?
But that actually goes against the contract that they've got with the council.
Yes, and you're putting pressure on the individuals to get somewhere smaller, but there aren't the smaller places for them to get. Yeah. So it doesn't matter how much pressure you put on people, if there aren't the places, they can't get them.
I imagine you have a lot of conversations like this, Paul, down at Crisis Centre Ministries, don't
Indeed,
you? About
yes.
Are there any things that pop up? I mean, I was asking Martin about this in the first hour, as solutions to this. Are you able to, for example, yourself actually house people?
We don't actually house people directly, but we have lots of contacts with people who house often unofficially, often outside the system, you know, private arrangements, people going to live with other folk. I think there is an awful lot of potential for people opening up their homes to having folk living with them on some sort of basis. You know, there are various ways of doing it. We know various community houses, and they're a fantastic way to live. But there's a lot of possibilities for people using the spare bedrooms. The bedroom tax, as Alan says, is dreadful. But one of the similar idiocies of the current system is that people can't rent out, you know, the spare bedroom. If they were allowed to use the spare bedrooms, the spare bedroom wouldn't be a problem.
What about the system? Because it's a system that's at fault, isn't it? It's not individuals, yeah. It's actually the system. I mean, certainly back in the 1970s, it was sorted for one reason or another. And I remember chatting to a former chairwoman of Knightstone Housing Association. Mm-hmm. She was involved in, named Stella, but she was involved in house building back in the 70s. And she said, well, I finished that job because we built enough houses for everybody.
She's still doing it, actually.
Yeah. So the system, how do we fix the system, either of you? Oh.
There's a number of things. We have to, I think myself, sort of curb the amount of people we bring into the country. And that's not that I'm against immigrants anywhere at all, but we need to look at how many people are coming into our country. And I think we actually got to start looking outside the box from the point of view that I think we need to start looking at more social enterprises where, as Paul was saying, so we recreate jobs for the people we are actually trying to house, so that they're paying their way as they come off the street, instead of just coming off the street and claiming dole. Something like Emmaus, which I have a lot of time for. Yeah. I think they have about 20, 30 people living, something like that. They run charity shops. They pay their people £30-40 a week. And they get back into mainstream living, and they're there with maybe 2-3 years, and then they generally move on.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we've got this thing, haven't we, structural unemployment nowadays. We've had it ever since they gave up on the idea of full employment. We've got structural unemployment, the idea that it's a good thing to have a million or a few million unemployed people. That's good for employers, because then they can sack someone and find someone nice and quick straight away afterwards.
Well, we've run, the society has been run. I mean, there was a commitment to housing the population after the Second World War, and it was a Conservative government, the Macmillan Burke government, that built the most council houses in Britain. And then we sort of lost the plot somewhere in the 1980s, sold off the council housing stock, which was very popular for those who benefited from it. But of course, what they should have done, if they're going to do that, is build some new ones.
Absolutely.
And also, of course, the other thing is you could make it incentives. We don't necessarily need to build loads more new houses. There's plenty of spare rooms around. We need to start using up, you know, think in terms of how do we house the population. And of course, after the war and the bombing and everything, there was a general commitment that, you know, we were going to have decent housing for everybody, and we've lost sight of that over the last decades. And we've just got to get the focus back onto it, because it's the most important thing for anybody, isn't it, somewhere decent to live.
Could I add to also the amount of houses and properties we've got in Bristol? We need some compulsory purchase orders put on them.
Yep.
I just walked up the road here now, and there's two houses here on the left hand, on the right hand side, totally derelict. And they've probably been like it for years, you know.
See, the interesting thing is, of course, many of the people I know that you'll be dealing with have got some of the skills that it would be needed to bring those back into use, those properties.
Yeah.
So do you think that, I mean, there must be some sort of line between whether people actually want a job or whether they'd rather just be surviving on benefits and have lots of free time. Do you think that there are some people who simply don't want to work?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think, of course, there is. There's always people who don't want to work. But I think also when you get people back into a routine, they get satisfaction out of it. They feel fulfilled. You know, they feel pride again. And I think, you know, that's what our country was always built on, you know, hard work. And we really need to get back to good values and Christian principles and get back on track.
Well, you mentioned Christianity again there. You're a faith-based organisation. I'll ask you both separately. What are the other sorts of facilities for homeless people in the city?
There's very few as regards, without being faith-based, there's Methodist Centre, which is fantastic. You've got Salvation Army, which is fantastic. And they're all self-referral. You can go in and get help. But, you know, the only other place, really, which is Compass Centre, but you have to make an appointment to go there. A good example, back a year or so ago, I found a lady on the streets, 47 years of age. She was literally on the streets. She went there, she got an appointment, and they gave her an appointment to come back a week later and put her back on the streets. And that same day, we found her somewhere to live, and she's still living in our property.
And what's your experience of mental illness? Because I know, sort of talking to the police, they will say that lots and lots of people that they're picking up. I mean, we had this thing, didn't we, earlier on in the week, of someone going crazy on an aircraft and it being escorted in by fighter jets. And I must admit, I thought that the authorities were rather disappointed that it wasn't a Muslim that had gone. It was just a kind of white guy who was gone crazy. But anyhow, about, you know, yes. Are you dealing quite a lot with people with presenting with mental illness?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are an awful lot of people with mental illnesses of all kinds.
Because I can remember back in the 1990s, Virginia Bottomley introducing something called Care in the Community.
Care in the Community. It was a great idea. Absolutely fantastic. The, you know, closed down large institutions, which, you know, quite often were not appropriate places for people to spend their lives in, have them cared for in small, much smaller units within the community. Great idea. The only difficulty with that plan is that it costs more to support people in smaller units in the community than it did in the big places they closed. They never allocated the finance to do it. So instead of caring for people in the community, they've essentially become homeless and they're filling up our prisons. And so instead of paying a little bit of money to keep them in the mental hospitals, we're paying far more to keep them in prisons. That makes no sense at all.
Well, amazing work that you're doing. I'm still coming back to this poor guy from Swindon in the wheelie bin. I imagine him trying to make a noise, screaming to try and stop the bin men putting him into the back of the dust cart. How do we stop? I'll give you both a chance to answer. So, how do we stop this kind of thing happening?
The reality is that very few homeless people will be sleeping in those bins. I mean, that it just doesn't make sense. They don't do it. They try and find places that are safe, which means mostly out of the way, because they don't want to be robbed when they're sleeping. So they want to find somewhere which is secure and where they won't be found. And so actually, the most useful thing is they talk to other homeless people and get advice. You know, the experts on this are the homeless people. And, you know, for most homeless people, actually, there's a strong community and they talk to each other. They found out where the best spots are and they do it very successfully.
Okay, Alan, what's your fix?
They'll go to the quieter areas, so they won't be in the shopping centres at night, because if they're sleeping doorways, they'll get urinated on, they'll get kicked by clubbers. So most of the time now, they'll go to the little graveyards, they'll go to the parks, they hide away, get maybe 2, 3, 4 hours sleep, and then they go up very early in the morning to try and find something to eat.
Can you just let us know, Paul, where your facilities are, for anyone listening that might know someone that might need them?
It's Carpenter House, bottom of Stapleton Road. It's the Wild Goose, next door to the Congregational Church, very close to the Leisure Centre.
Okay, and Alan, what about your centre?
Yeah, well, we've got one opening up now in Oldmarket, probably, which will be mid-September. But we do have an amazing shop up in Henbury, and if you're listening, in Crow Lane, lovely big shop selling really lovely furniture. And if you want to volunteer, go and speak to her. Please do.
Okay, well, that's Paul Hazelden, General Manager of Crisis Centre Ministries, and Alan Goddard, Operations Manager at Changing Lives. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, after that rather harrowing account of the wheelie bin death, Martin, we're going to go back to the Gaza story now and the Britain's Israel lobby. We're going to have a listen to an extract from the previous attack on Gaza. And this is a programme which is made by Peter Oborne as part of Dispatches. Have a little listen to a little extract from this. But tell us a little bit about Britain's Israel lobby.
Well, I mean, the Israeli lobby in Britain is strong. It's not as strong as in the US, but they're friends of Israel of all the major political parties, and they put a lot of effort into making sure that policy here fits in with what the Israeli government would like it to be.
Well, we had an extract, didn't we, from the British, I think it was, Labour Friends of Israel's annual meeting with David Miliband speaking just before this all kicked off in Gaza, and saying what a big friend of he was of Israel. But I suppose the other point of this is you can be a friend to somebody, but a critical friend.
Yes, I mean, I don't think we should judge people for being friends of Israel, but they should also be friends of Palestine. They should be friends of freedom. It's not. I don't think this is a question of anti-Semitism. Plenty of Jewish MPs, like Gerald Kaufman, have been bitter critics of the state of Israel and of its policies over the years, and that's exactly as it should be.
Okay, let's go back now 3 or 4 years to listen to a clip from this Dispatches documentary, Inside Britain's Israel Lobby.
Tonight on Dispatches, how British policy is influenced by supporters of a foreign power.
Something became skewed in British politics when an unelected friend of the Prime Minister had so much influence.
Dispatches reveals the activities of the most effective lobby working inside British political parties.
The pro-Israeli lobby in this country is the most powerful political lobby. There's nothing to touch them.
We investigate the Israel lobby's bankrolling of British politicians.
I don't believe, and I don't think anybody else would believe, that these contributions come with no strings attached.
The Israeli invasion of Gaza caused huge controversy. A few months later, the Conservative Friends of Israel held its annual lunch for Conservative politicians and businessmen. This year, the star speaker was David Cameron. I was astonished to note that he made no reference to the widespread killing of innocent civilians and massive destruction in Gaza 6 months earlier. Indeed, Cameron went out of his way to praise Israel because, so he said, it strives to protect innocent life. He said, if I become Prime Minister, Israel has a friend who will never turn his back on Israel. I resolved to ask questions. How does the pro-Israel lobby in Britain work? Who runs it? And how does it get results? What's clear is that support for Israel is a powerful presence in all the main parties.
Martin, what Peter Oborne's there is saying, effectively, is that this is the most powerful lobby at Westminster.
Well, it's certainly true in the United States. The American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee is dominant in choosing candidates for both major political parties. In Britain, it's more subtle, but still an enormous amount of influence is exerted behind the scenes. I mean, let's just compare, for example, the way Israel has been treated with the way Serbia was treated in the 1990s. Serbia was treated as an enemy state. We told them to withdraw from Kosovo, and if they didn't withdraw from Kosovo, there would be consequences. Then there were consequences, a 42-day bombing campaign, including hitting their television stations and so on, and eventually the Serbs were forced to disgorge Kosovo. Meanwhile, Israel is treated with kid gloves. And don't forget, if Israel gets away with attacking Gaza and the West Bank and so on, that sets a precedent for people all over the world to think that they can kick their neighbours around without any consequences to follow. And that's why the Israelis have got to be made to obey international law for the benefit of everybody.
We hear today the end of the Gaza ceasefire. Rockets and airstrikes are resuming. How long is this going to go on for this time, Martin?
Well, it's hard to say. I think the fact is that what might come out of this, if anybody's got any common sense, is that Hamas has got to be regarded as a legitimate participant in discussions to end the conflict. That what's really precipitated this latest bout of fighting is a rapprochement between Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas. And that, of course, enraged the Israelis, and that's why they've been throwing their rattle out of the pram and killing all of these people, to undermine that united front on the Palestinian side. Now, the Western powers and the rest of the world should regard a united front on the Palestinian side as a positive thing. It's quite possible, therefore, you could negotiate a solution, just as we've seen in Ireland and elsewhere.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, it's also this week the anniversary of Britain's entry into the First World War, and I'm going to play you now an extract from, I call it the Cousins War, and lots of the children of politicians at the time died in the First World War, and also there was discussion about bombing civilians. This is an extract from the Richard Bacon Show, and the two people you hear are Nicholas Pellett and Roger Mann from Monday's Five Live programme, which was from the Imperial War Museum.
And Asquith, for example, the British Prime Minister, yes, at the outbreak of war, he lost his eldest son Raymond at Somme in September 1916. Bonar Law, the Conservative leader, lost two sons. Lord Rothermere, the Air Minister, lost two sons. So it wasn't as if the families of those rulers weren't affected by the war.
Would it have been better if we'd just given a gun to each of the world leaders of the time, to Tsar Nicholas II, Kaiser Wilhelm II, George V, just given them a gun, let them sort it out themselves? Wouldn't that have been better?
That was an idea of George Bernard Shaw's.
Okay, have I stolen
should,
an idea?
The leaders should have fought it out in a football stadium.
Yeah.
I think he was probably tongue-in-cheek. What George Bernard Shaw wasn't tongue-in-cheek about, though, was when he wrote to the Times in September 1914 and suggested that there should be provision made for air raid shelters for children. And the Times refused to publish the letter because they said no civilised country would bomb civilians.
made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, following on from last week's creation versus evolution debate, we hear from legendary Arizona talk radio host and US naval intelligence veteran William Cooper now, and get his take on one of the great iconic films about the dawn of man, that's Stanley Kubrick's classic 2001, A Space Odyssey.
At one point, from the moon to Jupiter, man, represented on a microcosm by the astronauts making this voyage, came in conflict with their own technology. The technology of the human race was represented by the computer called HAL. And for those who were intelligent enough to experiment with the name HAL and progressed the letters one forward in the alphabet from what they were in the movie, H became I, A became B, and L became M. And they were able to see that the symbol was of the largest at that time when the movie was made, and the corporation that was on the cutting edge of computer technology, IBM. It was significant that man had built this technology, this computer, which had an artificial intelligence and was capable of communicating with the astronauts, and yet they had forgotten to put a switch in the machine which could be turned off at will. Now, you have to understand that this is all symbology. HAL represented many things. He represented the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, chemical warfare, bacteriological warfare, represented the state of the art of technology, where it became so complicated that no one man could be an expert in it, and thus might unknowingly participate in the building of a technology which could destroy him. Yet he only worked on a part or a portion of it, the knowledge of which did not indicate to him that the end product could be a danger. And we see that happening now, don't we? Where everybody has to specialize in one small portion of technology because the overall picture is so complicated and so far beyond our understanding that we see the prediction made in the movie 2001 actually becoming true before our very eyes. Just in my lifetime, I've seen automobiles that I could take apart and put together blindfolded myself as a teenager, to driving automobiles that I can lift the hood and not even recognize most of what I'm looking at, except that I know that it's an engine in there, and I know that it's got a fuel delivery system and some kind of a system that ignites the fuel, but the technology has surpassed my ability to take it apart and put it back together again without many months or years of specialized training. And this has occurred across the board in our technology. And as I've told you before, I will tell you again tonight, dear listeners, in secret, whatever you perceive as the state of technology in the public eye, the very cutting edge, in secret, they are a minimum of 50 to 100 years ahead, to the point where science fiction is no longer fiction and hasn't been for quite some time.
William Cooper there, speaking about the film 2001, A Space Odyssey and the Dawn of Man. Time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 and the Balloon Fiesta's live show coming up after 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's Councillor for Whitchurch Park, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Thanks also to Alan Goddard and Paul Hazelden. I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live. from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the US has carried out airstrikes against artillery used by Islamist militants in northern Iraq. Tens of thousands of members of religious minorities are seeking refuge from the fighters on Sinjar Mountain. America's also carried out humanitarian airdrops of food and water. Here's White House spokesman Josh Earnest.
The strategy right now is to try to meet the basic and immediate humanitarian needs of those who are trapped in these pretty terrible conditions. That is what prompted the airdrop of supplies that occurred overnight.
Meanwhile, the UK is releasing £8 million of emergency aid. Nigeria's president has declared a national state of emergency due to the Ebola virus. The outbreak in West Africa has also been labelled an international health emergency by the World Health Organization.